Do you fear God? Should you fear God? If so, how should you fear God? What does a right fear of God look like? We've been making our way through the book of Job over these last several weeks. Job was a wealthy man. He was a righteous man, and God himself says that Job was righteous and upright. And God says that he fears God. But then in a matter of minutes, Job loses all of his possessions. He loses all 10 of his children. And a short time thereafter, he loses his health. He has boils all over his body. His wife tells him he should curse God and die, but he doesn't curse God. He persists in fearing God. But then nothing changes. The pain continues. He endured the initial trauma, but as his hard circumstances continue day after day after day, he loses that confidence in God, and he curses the day that he was born. Meanwhile, some friends have arrived, three friends who have known him for a long time, and they are quiet with him, sit silently mourning with those who mourn for a full week. But when Job curses the day he was born, his friends think they need to correct him. And they say that Job is suffering because of his sin. That's the reason why he is undergoing all of these troubles. Job knows that that's not right. But he sees God as his enemy, tormenting him. He calls on God to give him an opportunity to present his case before him, to show that God is not right to have him suffer like this. Now, in the midst of all of Job's anguish, he does conclude that God will vindicate him on the last day after his death. And he rightly sees that God's ways are hidden and that wisdom requires that we fear God. But Job, until the end of his statements in chapter 31, still longs to present his case before God. We pointed out in the third sermon in the series that Job rightly saw that wisdom requires that he fear God, but he failed to see that wisdom requires that he also trust God's love. Well, Elihu then appears on the scene, a younger man who was present while Job and his friends were interacting with each other and was quiet as he waited for the elders to speak. But when they're quiet and Job is finished speaking, he speaks up and he rebukes both Job and his three friends. And Elihu makes three points, as we saw last week. First, that God is not Job's enemy, but he sends affliction for Job's good. God speaks to us not only through revelation, but he also speaks to us through pain. Secondly, Elihu says that God always does what is just and right. And thirdly, he says that we must be overwhelmed by the greatness of God's wondrous works. And it's that third point that we'll see God elaborates on this week. So in today's text, God picks up on Elihu's third point and effectively builds on what Elihu said in his first two points. God never rebukes Elihu, though he rebukes Job and his three friends. And then these last chapters show us that while Job knew he was to fear God, and while God commended Job for fearing him, Job did not yet fear God rightly. When Job had all of his wealth before he experienced all this suffering, he feared God, but there was something missing in his fear of God. Yet through the suffering that he experiences, and then in the midst of his suffering, seeing God for who he is, Job comes to fear God rightly. And having feared God rightly, he trusts God fully. The right fear of God keeps us from fearing anything else or anyone else. And the right fear of God leads us to trust in God's love. That seems a paradox, right? But it's the fear of God that enables us to rightly trust in God's love. So in this last section of Job, God teaches Job, and thus teaches us, the right fear of him. God shows himself to Job, and so shows himself to us. Today I've decided we're only going to go through verse 6 of chapter 42, Job's statement that we read. Next week we'll look at the concluding verses of chapter 42 and relate the theme of the whole book of Job to Romans 8:28 as we begin to look again at Romans. But our outline for today is this. First, see God for who he is and thus rightly fear him. Second, the point of creation. And third, the right fear of God. So first of all, see God for who he is and thus rightly fear him. Remember from last week that as Elihu concluded his speech, a storm is rolling in, the lightning is flashing, the thunder is sounding. Elihu says in verse 5 of chapter 37, God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. And then he concludes, the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. And then God speaks to display his great power, his justice, his wisdom, and his righteousness, which are all far beyond us, and so should prompt a fear of him. God speaks to Job, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. What's God saying? If you're so wise, if you're so righteous, if you're so powerful, then answer a few questions for me. He's getting Job to question, who am I? And particularly, who am I before God? Job has desired a mediator, one to whom he can present his case, who will then convince God that what God is doing to him is not right, that it's not just for a righteous man to suffer like this. Job wants God to be judged. He has tried to put God on trial. But we cannot put God on trial. That's like a 2 or 3 year old putting his parents on trial, right? Which a lot of 2 and 3 year olds want to do, right? They want to tell their parents, hey, you know, what you're doing is not right. I really should have gummy bears right now. But a 2 year old cannot put his parent on trial. And we cannot put God on trial. God does not answer to us, we answer to him. And so God is the one who asks the questions here when we appear before him. We are not the ones who ask him the questions. So God asks questions for most of chapters 38 to 41. He is showing himself to Job so that Job might rightly see him. We know this in part, that God is doing all this so that Job might see him, from Job's response in chapter 42, verse 5, what's on the front of your bulletin. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. God enables Job to see him, partly through his questioning. Job must see God for who he is and thus realize that he is a dependent creature, like a little child.
He must trust God. He must love God. He must delight in the greatness of God. And he can't put him on trial. Well, what does God say to help Job see this? Here's our outline for this section on the screen. He's got to see God in his creative acts. And then he has to see God in creation, in the completed creation, in the heavens and in the animals. So first of all, he has to see God in his creative acts. Verse 4 of chapter 38. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. And then sounding a lot like Genesis 1, God asks questions about separating light from darkness, separating the waters from the dry land, and the day from the night. And he concludes this section, verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. The point is, we can't begin to comprehend God's creation. And we're much too young to have seen it. We weren't born then. We're part of his creation. So how could we understand how he created it unless he tells us? We are his creatures. We are dependent upon him. Whatever is good in the world originated with God, not man. So how can we stand in judgment over the one who created all of his goodness? And then we need to see God in the creation itself. So God moves to discussing the various elements of creation. He turns first to the heavens. This is verses 22 to 38. We read most of this section during the service. I'm not going to read it again now. But he goes through snow, wind, rain, lightning, ice, and stars. God knows how to control all of them, and we don't know how to control any of them. He understands what they are. He knows where they came from. He uses each of them for his good and wise purposes. And we can do none of that. But then God turns from the heavens to the animals. And this is actually constitutes, surprisingly, by far the largest proportion of what God has to say to Job. He says, look at the animals. And then what animals does God highlight? It's interesting. They're all wild animals, with one rather wild exception. The lion, the raven, mountain goats, the wild donkey, the wild ox, the ostrich, the warhorse, there's our exception, the hawk, the eagle, behemoth, and leviathan. And so he asks Job, do you provide food for these animals? Do you even observe all they do? I see all they do. I see them when they give birth. Do you see everything that they do? Do you provide homes for these animals? Can you make them serve you? Implying they're always serving me. Verse 9. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? This is chapter 39. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valleys after you? No. God is the one who sees to it that all the animals serve him. And then he asks, do you make them to lack wisdom? Speaking of the stupid ostrich. Do you make them to run fast? Again, speaking of the ostrich. God made her stupid and he made her fast. Verse 17. speaking of the ostrich, God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share of understanding. But when she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you make the eagles fly? Do you make the eagles able to see their prey far, far away? Do you make the eagles play their role in the ecosystem? And then even the warhorse, the one tame animal, is not ours by right, and is hardly tame. It's not even ours under our complete control. God asked Job in 39:19-25, did you give the warhorse his might? Is it because you train him that he has strength? Did you give him his mane? Do you make him leap? Picking up in the middle of verse 20, his majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear. It is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains, and the shouting. Now, the horse was the most powerful weapon in the armies of that day. But that weapon was not created by humans, and it could hardly be controlled by them. That's God's point. Then these last two creatures, Behemoth and Leviathan, we're not sure what particular animals God is talking about, but that's really immaterial. They are represented as powerful creatures created by God for God's delight, not made by us, not made for us, not controllable by us. God says of the behemoth at the end of chapter 40, you didn't make him, Job, you cannot control him. Verse 15, behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. A fellow creature created for God's delight and glory, just like mankind. A creature made for God's delight and glory. And then Leviathan, chapter 41. You can't control him. We can't even kill him. And he is without fear. Verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fishhook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Implication, you'll be dead if you try to do that. So, God asks questions, pointing out his creative powers, his rights over his creation, his wise governing of creation, his view of everything which is happening, and pointing out our smallness, our impotence, our lack of wisdom. In comparison. Well, what's the point of this? Why does God point to creation and his creative acts? That leads us to our next heading. God's point is not that I'm so strong you need to do whatever I say. His point is not might makes right. Some have misunderstood what God says in Job in that way. But God is not speaking the way some parents speak to their kids. I'm stronger than you, I'm older than you, I'm bigger than you, so you better do what I say. Right, that's our temptation when we don't have any other way to control our kids. Now, in the midst of enabling Job to see him for who he is, God does emphasize his power and his majesty. But he also emphasizes his wisdom. He does emphasize his sovereign control, but he also emphasizes his good and wise purposes. So let's look at these purposes that God points out along the way as he speaks to Job. So all is mine to do with as I please, says God. God has created everything that we see. He created the stars, the lightning, the ostrich, the warhorse, behemoth, leviathan, us. God created all these things. We do not exist apart from him. We are dependent creatures. We are contingent creatures. Now, God's delight in his work of creation is evident in this text. All creation is doing what he planned for it, except the humans in the story, except Job and Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. And God intervenes in order to get these four men in alignment with his purposes. What are his purposes? His primary purpose is always that he is pleased to display his glory. God's glory is displayed in the heavens, in the animals, but God also speaks of how his glory is displayed in us, in mankind. How is his glory displayed in mankind? One way is that God humbles the proud and brings down the wicked. Chapter 40, verse 8. Will you even put me in the wrong? If we're doing that, if we're asserting that, we're acting out of pride. Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Now, that's the verse, or those few verses there are the ones that some people take out of context and think, oh, God is saying might makes right. But no, keep reading. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. There's his purpose. Look on everyone who is proud, repeated for our benefit, and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. The world needs a ruler. Mankind needs a ruler. Or the proud, the wicked, the strong will dominate others, will harm others, will destroy others. The wicked, the proud will thrive. God is not only mighty. God is the moral authority in the universe. He destroys the pride of men. He does not allow anyone to set himself up against God in the long run. And pride before God, my friends, is our fundamental sin. It's the sin at the root of every other sin. So God here is destroying Job's pride for Job's good. And then look at 41:11. Who is first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. We can't even have pride in what we offer to God. Even if we offer him our lives and all that we have, there's no pride in that. That's what's logical given who he is, what he has done, and who we are. We are simply the unworthy servants doing what he commands us when we give to him. We're going to see in several months that Paul picks up on this verse and quotes it at the end of Romans 11. So more coming on that great topic. So God humbles the proud and brings down the wicked. But then God also leads his people to delight in him and in his works. Back in chapter 38, when we read this, did you catch the result of God's initial act of creation? Verse 7. When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The result of God's initial act of creation was delight, was wonder, was joy at what God had done. God doesn't humble us just to bring us love. He humbles us so that we can then rightly delight in what is truly the source of joy, that is, himself. When we're so impressed with ourselves, we cannot delight in our dependence on God. We cannot stare in wonder and joy at the greatness of who he is and what he has done. Job was not delighting in God. He feared him in a sense, but that did not lead him into a delight and joy in God. But by the end of the book, he has that delight. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. You hear the note of delight in that. I had heard of you. Now I see you. Now I see you for who you are. And yes, I'm overwhelmed, I'm humbled, but I'm also rejoicing like a little child in the strength and love of his daddy. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. So Job is not just saying, I am humiliated. He's saying, I'm humbled. And he's saying, here is majestic joy. Here is overwhelming beauty. Here is overpowering magnificence. I see you, God, for who you are. And now, why would I rejoice in anything else? Why would I desire anything else? That's where Job ends up. That's the good work of God in humbling Job. Well, last point, the right fear of God. Let's look at Job's responses a bit more fully. Okay, the first time, back in chapter 40, then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. And then chapter 42. I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge, quoting what God had said to him? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. And then quoting God a second time. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you with the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. So, do you see how Job's fear has now changed? Previously, he saw God as his enemy, as his adversary, as harming him. And he had a fear of a capricious, arbitrary God. He knew that that was a wrong understanding of who God was. But his inability to understand what God was doing led him to fear of what this mysterious God might do to him. Have you experienced that fear? I've talked with a number of people who have felt that fear, and I've felt it myself at times. God, I've just gone through this tragedy. What else are you going to do to me? Distrusting God's wisdom and goodness and power. But now that Job sees God for who He is, in His glory, in His majesty, in His purposes, even in Job's suffering, when he sees that God is exalting what should be exalted, which is Himself, and God is humbling what should be humbled, which is the pride of man, then Job's fear is not the result of anticipating harm from God, but rather the result of seeing the great grandeur of God. He's overwhelmed by God's grandeur. And having a confidence that God, in His mysterious ways, is working for good and wise purposes. That's what a right fear of God brings about. A humbling of self and a delight in God, a trust in Him. And furthermore, a fear in nothing else, right? Because if you see God as all-powerful, as controlling, as sovereign, and good and wise, working for you, not against you, who can resist God? Not your earthly enemies, not demons, not Satan. When you rightly fear God, you fear nothing else. And when you rightly fear God, you love Him and trust Him and delight in Him. And that's why the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom is seeing God for who He is, seeing us for who we are, seeing the way that God rules the world and responding accordingly. That's what wisdom is. And Job now has that wisdom. He has seen God, he has seen himself, he has seen the way God rules the world, and he repents and he trusts God. What about you? What about you? Does your suffering or the suffering of your loved ones seem pointless, seem harsh, seem far beyond what you deserve or what they deserve, like Job's? Do you want to put God on trial? Do you think God needs to explain Himself? Do you think you have a good case against God? Do you question His wisdom, His power, His authority, or His love? God asks you what He asked Job. Do you see me? Do you see me? Do you see me for who I really am? See Him. See Him in His revelation, in His word, including this great book of Job. See Him as the Creator, and thus as the one who can do whatever He likes with His creation. See Him as the one who sees all, who sustains all, who controls all, who delights in all of His works. See Him in the heavens, in the thunderstorms, and the animals of His creation. And today, see Him in Jesus Christ, with all authority and all compassion, with all power and all humility. See Christ risen and reigning. See Christ suffering and dying. See Christ conquering all powers. And see Him humbly washing His disciples' feet. See Him riding on the white horse to conquer on the last day. And see Him holding children in His arms. This majestic, all-powerful God who asked Job, "Who darkens counsel without knowledge?" is the same God that became man and that lived in humility and died horribly so that you might be reconciled to that great and awesome God. So that you fearing God might be embraced by God. So see God for who He is. See God for who He is. And so come to fear God rightly. And having feared God rightly, trust Him fully. Having repented, being in Christ, there is nothing else to fear. The right fear of God leads to a trust in God's love. So fear Him. Know that you cannot stand before the Holy God on your own. Know that you cannot begin to understand God's ways. Know that His works bring joy and delight to those who are His. And so humble yourself. Rejoice in Him. Fear Him. And thus love Him with all your heart and soul and mind and strength.